Right now, Mrs. Kraft is a teacher, outgoing teacher at Mayanot, which is a very popular and prestigious yeshiva high school for girls in New Jersey. But she also has taught in many different venues, both in seminaries in Israel, as well as different places in New York, and traveled, and she herself having a degree and an advanced degree, a master's in Tanakh from Bernard Revel. So that's one set of hats that she wears, but she's also a mentor for younger women. She herself is an aspiring and accomplished already scholar. But the third hat that she wears is an incoming member of our community, because her husband, Rabbi Aaron Kraft, coming this fall, is going to be the new Rosh Chabura of our YU Torah Mitzion Kollel, and the Kraft family is going to be relocating, please God, to Lincolnwood this very summer. So this is a special opportunity for us, for the women of our community, to have the first opportunity to learn with Mrs. Kraft, although, please God, it's going to be the first of many. So even though they will be learning, living in Lincolnwood, we'll have the chance to share the Torah of the Krafts all around the community, both Rabbi Kraft and Mrs. Kraft. And the final hat that they wear, the most important, is that they are both spectacular human beings. And it's a wonderful, great zechus to have them as part of the Kollel family and our Chicago, greater Chicagoland family. And it's with that introduction that I present to you Mrs. Lynn Kraft. Thank you.
It's yours.
Thank you. Just press it. Oh, I didn't press it. Okay. Again, thank you, Rabbi Brand, and the entire Kollel for inviting me to speak. And my husband and I are really, really looking forward to moving here in 3 weeks, in Rosh Hashem. Hopefully Tisha B'Av should go okay, and we'll have all the boxes ready before then, and then we're coming. We're really, really excited. Sorry? Okay, absolutely. As you can tell from the title, we're going to be speaking today about Rachel and Leah, who are perhaps the most famous pair of sisters throughout all of Tanakh. And yet, their relationship is, to my knowledge at least, probably one of the least understood relationships in all of Tanakh. Were they loving and close? Were they antagonistic and distant? Did they share the same values? Did they have different life perspectives? Did Laban's trickery at the beginning of their joint marriage to Yaakov, or what ultimately became their joint marriage to Yaakov, did that trickery cause a rift in their relationship? Did it bring them closer? What was the relationship between these two sisters like? I think the reason why their relationship is so little understood is because so little is written about it in Tanakh itself. The Torah gives us very, very few lines about their relationship. For those of you who went to the Chavrusa prep, it might have seemed like a lot of lines to go through. However, we're really only given two prakim about that chapter in Yaakov's life, but not really very much about the relationship between Rachel and Leah themselves. And so in order to understand this relationship, what we're going to do today is read the few lines of text that we are given in the Torah. But what we are also going to have to do is read in between the lines as well. Their relationship, like I mentioned, or at least the relationship that I would like, that we're told about in the Torah, what little we are told of, begins right after the trickery of Lavan. And we are told right after the trickery of Lavan, Yaakov was extremely upset, of course, and he demands that he marry Rachel as well. Let's just take a step back. Yaakov was supposed to marry Rachel. Lavan tricks him and substitutes Leah instead. Yaakov only realizes in the morning. A lot of people learning Bechavrusa asked me a question about this. There was no electricity then. It was dark. He had no idea until morning. And he was extremely upset, and he demands that he also marry Rachel. And Lavan says, okay, finish the week of Sheva Brachot, or at least in current lingo, and then you can marry Rachel. And right afterwards, we're told in source number one, Peret Chav Tet in Bereshit, Pasuk Lamed, Ve'avo Gam El Rachel. And so this happened. Yaakov also married Rachel. Ve'ye'ehav Gam Et Rachel Mileya. And Yaakov also loved Rachel more than Leah. Note, however, that we are not told that he did not love Leah. Rather, he also loved Rachel more than Leah, implying, by the way, that Yaakov did love Leah, just not as much as Rachel. Vayavod yimo od sheva shanim achirod, and Yaakov then worked for Lavan for 7 more years. Vayar Hashem kisnua Leah. But Hashem saw that Leah was hated. Ah, but it says here that she was hated. However, the word snua in Tanakh does not really mean hated. The word snua in Tanakh is really just a comparative lashon to the word ahuva. What it really means is that the one who is more loved is known as ahuva. The one who is lesser loved is known as snua. It does not necessarily mean hated. The proof of this is that in Devarim, when we're told about a halacha regarding a man who has two wives, which, by the way, back then was allowed in the Torah, And each of these wives had children, and there's a debate as to who should get the Bechorah status, who should reap the benefits of being the firstborn, even though the eldest son might not be the son of the Ahuva, it might not be the son of the loved one, but rather the son of the Snua, the firstborn still gets the firstborn status. And there it is pretty clear that the Torah is not assuming that if a man marries two wives, one will be loved and one will be hated. That would probably mean that the Torah should have abolished that whole concept in the first place. But rather what it means is that if that happens, that there's more than one wife, one will be more loved and one will be less loved. But despite the level of loves, the firstborn remains the firstborn. And so we see in these two contexts that snua does not necessarily mean hated, but rather lesser loved. Hashem saw that Leah was lesser loved. Vayiftach et Rachma v'Rachel akara. Because Hashem saw that Leah was not as much loved as Rachel, Hashem opened her womb, implying, by the way, that Leah was supposed to be Akara as well. She was supposed to be barren as well. However, because of her circumstances in her relationship with Yaakov, Hashem decided to open up her womb from being closed. But Rachel remained barren as she was supposed to be, so to speak. We know all of the other Imahot, Sarah and Rivka and Rachel and Leah also should have been Akara. They are all barren of children. What we see here in these two psukim is a real imbalance in two different respects between Rachel and Leah in the context of their marriage to Yaakov. On the one hand, we have Yaakov's love. It is very clear that Rachel receives the lion's share of the love, and Leah receives less of it. In fact, in source number 2, Rut Rabba explains this, and he says, Amar Rabbi Yitzhak explains, Rachel haita ikaro shel bayit. Rachel was the mainstay of the home. She was the main recipient of Yaakov's love. Lefichach v'Rachel akara. And that's why it says in the pasuk that Rachel was barren. But don't read it as akara, rather ikara shel bayit. Right? She was not only barren of children, but she was also ikar, which has the same shoresh as akara. She was also the mainstay of the home. As opposed to Leah, if you look in source number 3, the Bereshit Rabbah explains, Leah shahaita akara min habayit. In terms of the bayit, which according to the Midrash, or the Midrash is using this language to symbolize Yaakov's love, according to the pshat, really, and the Midrash is really just picking up on this, Rachel was the ikara shel habayit. She was the mainstay of the home. She was the main recipient of Yaakov's love. Whereas Leah was the akara min habayit. Leah was the one who was lacking in Yaakov's love. The second imbalance that we see is in terms of children, right? Very clearly in the psukim that we saw before, Pasuk Lamed Aleph in source number 1, we see Vayiftach et Rachma, referring to Leah. Leah's womb was opened, and she subsequently has 6 children, whereas Rachel was akara, Rachel was barren. And so we see a second imbalance in terms of children, where Leah is the main one, right? Leah is the main mother, whereas Rachel is lacking in children. What was the response of each sister to her inequity? Right? How did they each respond? So first we're told of Leah's response. If you turn to source number 4, in Bereshit Perek Chavtet, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, following immediately where we left off in source number 1, Leah has 4 children, one right after another. We're not going to do every single Pasuk inside, but with every single child, she names her child as a tefillah to Hashem to increase Yaakov's love for her. She feels this sore lacking of love that she is receiving or not really receiving from Yaakov. And with each child, she davens that his love would increase for her. For example, in the first pasuk, Pasuk Lamed Bet, Vatar Leah Vatelet Bein, right, she became pregnant and had a son. Vatikra Shemo Reuven. She called him Reuven ki Amra, because she said, Ki Ra'a Hashem Be'oni ki Ata Ye'ehaveni Ishi. Hashem has seen my affliction and that I'm not as much loved. Now maybe my husband will love me. Shimon is also because she was not as loved. Levi is also, now my husband will have to escort me because my 2 hands are full with my 2 children. Now that I have a 3rd, Yaakov is going to be forced to spend time with me. And we see, and we'll see why Yehuda, she no longer discusses her son, her husband's love, and we'll discuss that a little bit later. But certainly for her first 3 children, her response to her inequity, if not explicit in the text, certainly is implicitly one of jealousy. She can't handle the fact, that Rachel is receiving the lion's share of love, whereas she is not. And she seems to be viewing her children as vehicles through which to earn her husband's love. While I'm sure that Leah certainly loved them, I'm not saying or trying to say that Leah did not love her children at all, but she certainly not only loved them, but saw them as means through which to hopefully gain more of Yaakov's love than she currently had. Rachel's response is a lot more explicit. What is Rachel's response? Also, source number 5, immediately following source number 4, it just begins a new perek. Vatera Rachel ki lo yalda li Yaakov. Rachel saw that her sister has just given birth to 4 successive sons, and she had not given birth once. Vatekane Rachel ba'achota. Rachel was jealous. We are told this very explicitly in the Psukim. Rachel felt that sense, that twinge, really strong twinge of jealousy. She couldn't handle the fact that even though she was the main recipient of Yaakov's love, she could not handle the fact that she was not blessed with his children. She takes this so personally, and it means so much to her, that she basically yells at Yaakov. Vatomer al Yaakov, havali banim, v'im ayin meta anochi. Give me children, and if not, I'm going to die. Because to Rachel, it seems, a life without children was a life not worth living. Yaakov became very angry with her. He very much disagreed with her, and we'll get there a little bit later. But it's important for now to realize and to understand that Rachel's response was one of extreme jealousy, and even perhaps anger, that the blessing of children was withheld from her. Several psukim later, we're told of the first and really only interaction that we're told of in the Torah between Rachel and Leah. If you turn now to source number 6, in Perek Lamed, we have the story of the Dudaim. I'll explain what those are in a minute. Vayelech Reuven bimei Ketzir Chitim. Leah's eldest, Reuven, her bechor, her firstborn, probably not much older than 5, 6, 7, a young boy, was walking in the days of the wheat harvest. He was taking a walk. Vayimtsa Dudaim basadeh. And he found Dudaim in the field. What are Dudaim? So they're usually, as you can see from the English translation, Dudaim are usually translated as mandrakes, which doesn't really mean much to us. What is the significance of these Dudaim? The commentaries basically they agree on the main point. Some say that it served as an ancient aphrodisiac, a way to lure one's husband into having relations with the ultimate purpose of becoming pregnant. The others say, no, it was a fertility drug. It did not aid in the process of becoming pregnant through aphrodisiac uses, but rather through the use of aiding in the process of conception itself. Either way, these Dudaim were known in ancient times to aid in a woman's becoming pregnant. Vayaveotam aleya imo. And he brings these Dudaim to his mother Leah. Now, since Leah birthed Yaakov, it says Vata'amod miledet, she had not had any more children. And Reuven thought that it would be appropriate to give her these Dudaim. What's also interesting, and this, well, I'll just spend a minute on it. Rav Yonatan Grossman, who writes for the VBM, has a really interesting comment. He says that, first of all, it seems that there was no occasion. It wasn't Leah's birthday or anything significant. There was no real reason for Reuven to bring Leah these Dudaim. He was bringing them to her because he loved her, because she was his mother. And if you look throughout the text, they are constantly referred to by Rachel and Leah as Dudai b'neich and Dudai b'ni, your son's Dudaim, my son's Dudaim. Because they weren't just a fertility drug or an aphrodisiac in order to aid in the process of becoming pregnant, but they also represented a son's love for his mother, something that Rachel felt sorely lacking. And therefore, what does she say? Vatoma Rachel Aleya Tnina Limi Dudai b'neich. Please, can I have those mandrakes? Whether for the purposes of an aphrodisiac, or because she wanted a fertility drug, or just because they symbolized that which she was so sorely lacking in her life, she wanted them. How does Leah respond? Pasuk Tetvav. Vatomer la hame'akach techet ishi, v'lakachat gam et duda ebni. Is it not enough that you have taken my husband? Now you're also going to take my mandrakes, my son's mandrakes? Right? Leah, here we basically see their jealousies come to a head. Rachel is willing to do anything for these Dudaim, to the point that she ultimately, in the next pasuk, gives up Yaakov, the direct way of becoming pregnant, for these Dudaim, which at best would be indirect, right? You need the husband in order for the fertility drug or the aphrodisiac to work. But she's willing to give Yaakov up for the Dudaim. Her jealousy has so blinded her that she's willing to make that sacrifice, I guess, so to speak. And Leah here defends herself and says, absolutely not. How could you? Right? How could you want or even express the desire to take my son's mandrakes when you already have my husband? Right? Leah is resentful of the fact that Rachel has been the primary recipient of Yaakov's love. Rachel is resentful of the fact that Leah has been the primary mother in Yaakov's household. And here we really see through their interaction that jealousy comes to a head. And what I would like to discuss now is that unfortunately this kinna that we see between the two sisters does not die with them. Rather, we see the consequences of this jealousy, this kinna, last for generations. It was likely this kinna that motivated Reuven to switch Yaakov's bed from Bilhah's tent after Rachel's death to Leah's tent, because he felt that Leah deserved to have Yaakov sleep with her, right? To spend his nights with her. It was likely this kinna, this jealousy, that fueled Shimon and Levi's rage and subsequent murder of the people of Shechem in defense of their sister Dinah's honor. perhaps because they thought Yaakov wasn't standing up to it enough, wasn't defending her honor enough because she was Leah's daughter and not Rachel's. It was perhaps most famously, and perhaps even most significantly, the cause of Mechirat Yosef, the cause of the sale of Joseph down to Mitzrayim, which altered the rest of Jewish history. We also see it reincarnated generations later between Shaul and David. Shaul was the first king of Bnei Yisrael from Shevet Binyamin, who was Rachel's son, who was insanely, intensely jealous of David, who was from Shevet Yehuda, who was Leah's son, Leah's son, who was supposed to take his dynasty away from him and start his own dynasty as well. And I believe we even see it in Megillat Esther, because Mordechai and Esther are both from Shevet Binyamin. Esther was the one who rose to power. Right, it's kind of like a reincarnation of Shaul and David, some say. Esther's the one who rose to power, but she was scared to approach Ahasuerus when Mordechai told her to save the Jews. What does Mordechai respond to this passivity? He says, if you don't act fast, revach v'hatzalah yavo mimakom acher. Salvation is going to come from another place. What other place is going to provide the salvation? He says, Hashem will save the Jewish people, but it won't come through you. And then he continues, and he makes it clear what other place he's talking about. V'at uveit avich yovedu. If you don't act fast, not only will salvation come from another place, you and your father's household will be destroyed. You, as a queen from Shevet Binyamin, will destroy that leadership from Shevet Binyamin, and it will be handed over to Yehuda, who is the more likely choice for leadership amongst the Jewish people. And so we see that this kina has really outlasted Rachel and Leah, has impacted Jewish history for generation after generation after generation. So much so that it's no wonder that the Torah records a halacha in Vayikra Perek Yitchet Pasuk Yitchet in source number 7, V'isha el achota lotikach litzor legalot et ervata. Do not marry two sisters, because they will rise to become sarot. They will become enemies of one another. Right? It's one of the arayot. A man may marry two women, but they may not. They must not be sisters. It's no wonder that the Torah records this halacha in light of what happened between Rachel and Leah. After analyzing the extent and the impact of their jealousies, what I would like to focus on now is a really important question that arises from this. You know, we're discussing Imahot here. We're not discussing, you know, me and my sister, though I don't have one. We're not discussing anyone here and their sister. We're discussing Imahot. We're discussing the mothers of the people, women who are always viewed in our heritage as Nashim Tzidkaniot, as righteous women, women who are supposed to be role models to us. How could these amazing women have succumbed to such strong feelings of jealousy, right? We're told in the Torah that we shouldn't be jealous. How could they have succumbed to these strong feelings of jealousy? And you might say, I've already given you the answer, right? It's very clear in the text. And in some ways, that's true. They've each been dealt, at least on a superficial level, based on their external circumstances, they've been dealt a really hard life. They were in a very, very tough position. They each experienced a very, very real tzara that had not only a major impact on them themselves, which it did, but also on the relationship between the two of them. And that's it. I can end my share here and go home. However, I believe that if we probe a little bit deeper, if we go beneath the surface, right, probe a little bit further than their external life circumstances, I believe that we can learn a lot, not only by analyzing what brought Rachel and Leah together, but also by trying to figure out what set them apart. What is the difference between Rachel and Leah that might shed light upon this kina, that might help us understand what brought them to succumb to such strong feelings of jealousy? Now, there are several differences between Rachel and Leah that emerge from the Torah's narratives about them, many, in fact, but I would like to begin with the most relevant one, that being the difference between each of their approaches to marriage. What is the fundamental purpose of marriage? And the truth is, the Torah itself tells us what the fundamental purpose of marriage is. It tells us this after the first marriage ever recorded or ever to happen in the world, forget about recorded in the Torah, ever to happen in the world, right, in the history of mankind, the union of Adam and Chava. As soon as Chava was created from Adam himself, we know that Hashem takes the bone out of Adam and builds it up into woman. Adam makes a very romantic proclamation in source number 8. In Pasuk Chav Gimel, third Pasuk down, Vayomer HaAdam, Zot HaPam Etzem Me'atzamayu Basar Mibsari. This time, right, he had looked at all the animals and didn't find anyone who he could relate to, but this time, this was someone from his own bones and of his own flesh. Chava, he proclaims, shares his essence. They are one and the same. They share the same essential components of humanity. I will call her woman because she was taken from man. And then the Torah inserts a narrative statement. Because Adam felt this way, therefore all men in subsequent generations shall unite with a woman. Therefore, because man and woman feel such a strong connection to one another, man shall leave his father and his mother. And what is the ultimate purpose of the leaving of his father and mother? V'davak b'ishto v'hayu levasar echad. The ultimate fundamental purpose of marriage is to cleave, is for man to cleave unto his wife and become one flesh. What does that mean? That you should cleave, a man should cleave unto his wife and become one flesh. How can two separate human beings come together to form one entity, that one flesh? We're two separate beings. How can we form one flesh? In fact, this is the subject of a very classic machloket between Rashi and Ramban. And we'll see that at least the difference in their viewpoints upon the, about the purpose of marriage. Rashi, in source number 9, explains that v'hayu levasar echad, how do two separate human beings join together in one flesh? Havlad notzar al yedei shneihem, through their children. Because the fetus is made up of both his father or her father and his or her mother. We know scientifically this to be true. The genetic material of both the father and the mother fused together to form a new human being, to form a new flesh. Visham na'aseh b'saram echad. And according to Rashi, it is through their children that they become one flesh. Therefore, according to Rashi, the fundamental purpose of marriage, we know from the Torah, is v'hayu levasar echad, and therefore, according to Rashi, the fundamental purpose of marriage seems to be to have children. Ah, says the Ramban, that can't be. Why can't that be? Because animals can do the same thing. Animals also fuse their genetic material together to form children. How could it be, says the Ramban, that our lofty goal of marriage can be achieved by mere animals? He says, that can't be. The conception of marriage is something that is unique to humanity. It is something that only lofty human beings can attain. Because if you look at the nature of an animal, a male animal will find any random female that crosses its path, mate with it, and then leave. There's absolutely no connection between those two animals. It's random. And so the union, the marriage union is not applicable to animals, but rather to human beings, because human beings are different. And here we'll start in the middle of the Ramban. Three lines down from the second paragraph. Ba'avor shenikevan ha'adam hayta etzem me'atzamav u'basar mibsaro. Because the female aspect of man, Chava, was bone of his bones and flesh of his flesh, v'davakba, and he cleaves unto her, v'hayta b'cheko kivsaro, and she was in his embrace as one flesh. V'yachpotzba li'yotat tamidimo, and he desired to be with her always. What the Ramban is saying here is that v'hayu levasar echad does not necessarily mean in having children, but rather through having an intimate relationship. Both physically, through a physical embrace, v'hayu levasar echad, you can become as one flesh. If you're so close together, your two bodies can become one. But also in your emotional desire to be with one another, in your emotional embrace, so to speak, you can become one. V'ka'asher hayaza be'adam, and because this was the way that Adam felt toward Chava, Hashem placed that nature in the rest of his descendants, in subsequent generations as well. So that all future men would want to cleave to their wives, leave their parents, and shall come to view their wives as being as the same flesh as them. So the Ramban holds, therefore, that the ultimate purpose of marriage is not necessarily to have children, but rather to have a close and intimate relationship between the spouses. And it is through that close and intimate relationship between the spouses that they can become basar echad and achieve the ultimate purpose of marriage. And I think that through understanding this machloket Ramban versus Rashi, we can now understand the different approaches that Rachel and Leah had towards marriage. Because it seems that Rachel agreed with Rashi. Rachel thought that the fundamental purpose of marriage was to have children. V'ayul v'asar echad, according to Rashi, is that you become one flesh through your child. And so Rachel felt that she had, that her sister was fulfilling her mission, was fulfilling her goal, her ultimate purpose in her marriage to Yaakov, and that she was falling short. She was not able to fulfill the ultimate purpose of her marriage to Yaakov in her own interpretation of that purpose. Whereas Leah felt the opposite, because Leah agreed with the Ramban. To Leah, the ultimate purpose of marriage was really to have that close and intimate relationship with your husband. To Leah, Rachel had achieved the ultimate purpose of marriage, whereas she herself felt that she had fallen short. And so now we see that perhaps the underlying cause of their kinah, the underlying root of the jealousies between the two sisters, really was based in their different approaches to marriage. The question that I would like to ask now is, why would Rachel be inclined towards Rashi's approach and Leah be inclined towards Ramban? Right? Why would Rachel feel that children were the ultimate purpose of marriage? Where would she get that from? Whereas Leah, who grew up in the same household as her, they were sisters, would agree with the Ramban and believe that no, the ultimate purpose of marriage was to have a close relationship. Where did they each get their differing points of view? Yes?
You also have to bring in the culture at that time.
Yes.
The culture was a woman in the household,
so that could be the one of the ways that even in that culture was viewed at the time. However, at least within the Avot, I don't believe that Avraham treated Sarah in that way. Avraham and Sarah had an unbelievable relationship, even though Sarah was an Akara for 90 years. So to my knowledge, that's, as we'll explain soon, is a piece of the puzzle, but not necessarily the whole puzzle. Many different... Yes? I'm sorry? Yes? Yes. Now, Sarah threw Hagar out after Vatakel Gvir Tab Eineha, right? After Hagar started treating Sarah lightly, not as her mistress, but as her equal, because she was pregnant and Sarah was not. Not necessarily because Hagar received Avraham's love more than Sarah did. Absolutely. Absolutely. However, just important to note that in the text, the motivation really seems to lie in Hagar's treatment of her, or in her change of perspective, or in her change of view towards Sarah. But point well taken. There are many different attempts that have been made to describe the difference between Rachel and Leah throughout the ages. I mean, from the Zohar to current online forums, we have many different attempts at trying to distinguish Rachel and Leah from each other, to try to decipher what made each of the sisters unique from the other. The perspective that I would like to take today that I find most applicable or relevant in this context is the one championed by Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav, the Rosh Yeshiva of YU originally, etc. It actually appears in an article of his in the new book that came out called Vision and Leadership, Reflections on Joseph and Moses. It's actually excerpted for you in source number 11. The Rav explains, and we'll read in a second, the Rav explains that the difference between Rachel and Leah is that between the Mida of Gvura, well, I should say the opposite. Leah, he says, personifies Midat HaGvura, the character trait of strength, whereas Rachel personifies Midat HaChesed, the character trait of kindness, of loving kindness, of sacrifice. What does that mean, and what on earth does that have to do with what we're talking about? So if you look in source number 11, I think that he's going to shed light upon what we've been talking about so far. Throughout the Bible, people fought for power, strength, and independence. Here he's discussing Midat HaGvura. What is the character trait of strength? Throughout the Bible, we see that Midat HaGvura was very important. The character trait of strength has been a value. People have fought for power, strength, and independence. Without power, one cannot be majestic and dignified. Majesty and dignity are moral virtues. Of course, the majesty and dignity of the human being expresses itself in the fact that man has inalienable rights. Human beings have a moral right to defend their possessions and, if necessary, to fight for them. The dignity of man expresses itself through his ability to take a stand and to defend whatever God has given him. What the Rav explains is that the Midah of Gvura, the character's trait of strength, enables one to walk around with majesty and dignity, to walk with their head held up high, to feel a sense of pride with who they are and what they stand for and the values that they represent. And it leads one to defend themselves in the face of a threat. I have a right to this, and I'm a man or woman of dignity, and therefore I will defend my right to that. If you skip to the second to last paragraph, the Rav explains, Leah was the personification of Midat HaGvura, of dignity and majesty. God wanted her to fight for her elementary rights. And as the Rav goes on to explain, we see this Midat HaGvura, this character trait of strength in Leah, when she agrees to Lavan's scheme. He says that for Leah to agree to Lavan's scheme, she had to display a lot of courage. Because she very well knew that Yaakov could have thrown her out that next morning when he found out that she had agreed and pretended that she was Rachel. And yet, Leah had the courage to agree with it. Why? As the Rav says, for every young woman has a right to marry a young man. And she was defending her rights as a young woman. I think that we see this in the text as well a little bit later, which we've already read. If you turn back to source number 6 for a second, when Rachel asks for the Dudaim that Reuven had brought to Leah, Leah's response is, "Hama'akach techet ishi v'lakachah gam edudai b'ni." Not only have you taken my husband, but now you also want to take my son's Dudaim? In other words, Leah here is very strongly defending her rights to both her husband and to her son. Because in fact, her union with Yaakov was legitimate. Yaakov recognized her as his wife. He did not kick her out, even though that was a risk. And so what Leah says is that he is as much my husband as he is yours, Rachel. And therefore, how dare you try to take him from me? How dare you try to take my son as well, right? She is here defending her rights and basically acting with majesty and dignity with Midat HaGvura. Rachel, on the other hand, is a little bit different. Now the Rav is going to speak about Midat HaChesed. Second paragraph in source number 11. However, the covenantal community displays another trait as well. Sacrificial action, the ability to give away and to renounce basic inalienable rights for the sake of a great vision, an ideal, or for the benefit of another human being or community. Chesed, on the other hand, as opposed to defending one's rights, chesed is the ability to give them up for the sake of something greater than oneself, either for a goal, for a vision, for an ideal that you have, or for the sake of another human being's happiness. Last paragraph, Rachel is the opposite of Leah. She is the tragic heroine who lives for others and not for herself. She gave up her most precious possessions and her elementary rights in order to make it possible for others to find the happiness denied them. Rachel represents chesed. I think we see this most clearly in the midrash that many of us know about the Simanim, right? When Rachel saw that Lavan was going to go through with this plan, even though she and Yaakov had planned signs beforehand to prevent this from happening, Rachel could not see her sister humiliated like that. She could not see Yaakov give, or hear later, that Yaakov had given over the signs and Leah could not respond, and Leah and Yaakov had then found out and humiliated her sister. And so according to the Midrash, Rachel gave over those simanim. She gave over those signs so that Yaakov would not know the whole night that it was in fact Leah and not Rachel. Here we see the classic act of self-sacrifice, giving up her own betrothed, her own love, the man that she loved, so that her sister would not be humiliated. And I don't even think we have to go all the way to the Midrash for that. I think we see that in the text as well. If you look in source number 12, which describes the whole path, the whole process of Lavan's trickery, from the beginning of Yaakov's requesting to marry Rachel to the end, Vayehi Baboker Vehinehi Leah, we do not see Rachel's name once. Rachel is silent. The least she could have done is try to prevent Lavan from doing it, warn Yaakov that something was happening, do something. And yet, she is not mentioned once in the Pesukim, showing her tacit approval of what was going on, or her tacit allowance for Leah to do what she was doing. In addition to this, I think that there's another indication in the text that Rachel embodies Midat HaChesed, as the Rav explains. And this is going back to source number 5 that we've already read. When Rachel yells at Yaakov and says, Havali banim v'imayin meta anochi, Rachel is essentially saying, give me children or I will die, because my life is not worth living if I can't live for others. Rachel is essentially saying that she does not live for herself. She is only living for other children. She is saying that her life is one of sacrifice. She does not feel like living for herself. She only wants to live for others. And here we see that Rachel in fact displays this Midat HaChesed. Yes?
I just was thinking about the names that Rachel chose versus the ones that Leah chose.
Interesting. Okay.
And Rachel's being much more I don't know how to describe it, but God is constantly challenging me.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's how she views her life. Absolutely. Thank you. That's a very, very important point.
Sorry, just to add to that.
Sure.
The names she chose for Rachel, just for her children, were born through her handmaid.
At that point, yes, absolutely.
Done.
Absolutely. Right, done enough, Tali. Absolutely. Yes.
I think you also see Rachel's chesed with the Dudaim. She doesn't throw it back in Leah's face.
Okay. Good.
I gave you the Simanim.
Good. What do you mean, Hama'akach teichat ishi? Hama'akach teichat ishi? Right? You took my husband. Absolutely. She has a lot of self-restraint there. Thank you. Very good point. Yes.
Is it just a question of having children or having the Shvatim and having being
good question.
Part of building the nation?
What would be the difference between them? I mean, what difference is there between having children or having the Shvatim?
Well,
what would one cause more pain or
just, you know, now.
Okay.
Rachel and her husband, and she'd like to have a child.
Okay.
But it's also, here's this huge beginning of a nation that's
yes,
about
absolutely.
To be built.
Absolutely.
And she's kind of left out.
Absolutely. That certainly
While
impacts
Maria,
the whole picture.
There because she allowed her to be really,
okay.
Sacrifice.
Is part of the whole picture, ultimately.
She's good. Having, in a sense, more than her share.
Okay.
She had Yehuda, she had more than a quarter of the Shvatim.
Okay. Yeah.
So when you say that she emulates Chesed, are we saying that that is a positive?
Okay, so we'll get there. Give me a few minutes. We'll get there. Okay. Yes?
I don't take any more questions. Just go on.
Okay. I just take the last question, and then I'll move on. Yes?
In terms of their future roles, like you talk about Rachel being on Keres Bayit, like more of a housefrau, and Leah more of the Asanid, which you see with Dina. You see it also in history also that Rachel is there at the beginning.
Yes, good.
And when you have the kings from the house of Yemen, so they're kind of low key, but David HaMelech is a
good. Absolutely.
Big
player. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, like I said, there are very many differences we can speak about between Rachel and Leah. I chose for this the purpose of the share, and we'll see why, to focus on the Chesed and Gvura, but I think that that plays out in a lot of what everyone's been suggesting. So thank you for your insight. Now, I believe that understanding the differences between Rachel and Leah through this particular difference that I've chosen to discuss today, the difference between Chesed and Gvura, really does shed light on their different approaches to marriage. Rachel, who viewed the fundamental purpose of marriage as being to have children, it makes sense because her midah was one of Chesed. Her midah was one of sacrifice, right? The ultimate sacrifice in someone's life is to have children and to give your all to them, right? The children represent one's ultimate sacrifice. And so it makes sense that someone who has that natural inclination towards the midah of Chesed would want to kind of actualize that inherent inclination through children, because that is kind of like the best way or the most ultimate way to exhibit that sense of self-sacrifice. Leah, on the other hand, exemplified midat hagvura, right? She exemplified strength. She exemplified the idea of majesty and dignity. And that is something that comes through being valued by another human being. Being the recipient of your husband's love shows that he values you for who you are. That lends you a sense of majesty and dignity. I'm worth something. I'm someone of value because someone else appreciates me. Now, that is not to say that there is no giving in a husband-wife relationship, chas v'shalom. It's just that it pales in comparison to that of between, a mother or parent and her children. And I do think that we do see this value of majesty and dignity through the appreciation and the love that one can receive from one's spouse. As such, while Rachel was experiencing through her relationship with Yaakov this majesty and dignity, she really yearned for the sacrifice that would come through having children. And Leah, who was experiencing the sacrifice necessary through having children, really yearned for the majesty and dignity that would come from her husband's love. What the sisters didn't understand, and this is where I'm getting to answering your question, is that they didn't see the whole picture. If you look in the middle of the Rav source, going back to source number 11, the middle paragraph that I purposely skipped until now, covenantal man, which is the Rav's way of referring to Jews, knows when to act like a warrior, majestic, dignified, proud, and when to part with everything he has. In other words, a man has to know when to act b'midat hagvura, when to act with strength, and when to act b'midat hachased, when to act with sacrifice. Man must know the secret of when to retreat into his private four cubits and shut the gates, so to say, and when he should tear down those fences and the barriers and live an open life. Man has to know that life is made up of both chesed and gvura. You just have to know when to use each. It is paradoxical, but that is Judaism. And I think that this same point is made in a different context by the Akedat Yitzchak in source number 13. Due to interest of time, we're not going to go through it inside. However, what the Akedat Yitzchak says is very valuable. The Akedat Yitzchak explains that essentially women have two roles in life. And he bases it on the two names that Adam gives to Chava. First, as we read before, Adam calls Chava Isha. Ki me ishlu kachazo, you are a woman because you are taken from man. Says the Akedat Yitzchak, the first, and says Nachum Leibovitz, even primary role of woman is to be a woman. In the way that she shares the same intellectual capacity as man, in the way that she shares the same religious potential as man, in the way that she is as human as a man, that is her role, to be a human being, along with man. To be a woman for all that humans stand for, right? And this is amazing that the Akedat Yitzchak, who lived centuries ago, was the one to say this, but he says that the primary role of woman is to be a woman, to live her life as a human being, to contribute to society as a man can. Her second, and according to Nechama Leibovitz, secondary role is based on the second name that Adam gave to Chava after the sin, which is Chava ki he'im kol chai. Her name is Chava because she is the mother of all living things. According to the Akedah Yitzhak, being a mother is woman's second, if not secondary, goal in the context of her role as woman. Says the Akedah Yitzhak, that is why Yaakov got so mad at Rachel when she said, Hava li banim v'mayim eta anochi. When Rachel said, my life is not worth living if I don't have children, vayicharaf Yaakov berachel. Yaakov got angry at her. He says, that's not true. Your life is not all about having children. You are a woman just like I am a man. Whether or not you have children doesn't impact your role of woman. Of course your life is worth living. And so what we see from both the Akedah Yitzhak and the Rav is that we really need both. It is not one to the exclusion of the other. But rather, marriage is really a composite picture of the two roles we can fulfill as women, of the two different midot that we can actualize in ourselves. Both chesed and gvura are necessary traits. Being a woman is important in and of itself. Being a mother is important in and of itself. In fact, the true purpose of marriage is most likely, in an ideal world, the combination of Rashi's and Ramban's approaches. It's about both the Isha and the Chava, right? Both the intimate relationship and the mother. Fortunately, in the end, we see that Rachel and Leah did come to see the whole picture. They were able, as they did living with each other day in, day out, they were gradually able to learn from each other and become influenced by each other's sister and by each sister, but each sister was able to be influenced by the other and learn from each other's perspectives. Mrs. Dina Cooper-Smith is a teacher at Eish HaTorah, and she develops the idea that Leah and Rachel needed to be influenced by one another in order to create the family that would ultimately become Am Yisrael. Rachel and Leah needed to be influenced by each other in order to develop more synthesis and wholeness within themselves. Because Yaakov's midah was one of Emet. We know that Emet, according to Chazal, is the combination of Chesed and Gvura. Originally, he matched up with his wives because one wife was Chesed and one wife was Gvura. Together, they matched him. But ultimately, they each on their own had to emulate Emet as well. They themselves had to integrate both Chesed and Gvura within themselves to emulate Yaakov. So Rachel, who embodied Midat HaChesed, ultimately needed to learn Midat HaGvura. And in fact, she did. She learned from Leah's Gvura. Leah's Gvura, her courage at marrying Yaakov, at agreeing to Laban's scheme, even when she knew she risked being thrown out of the house and humiliated. Leah's strength in her persistence in earning Yaakov's love through every single name she gave to her children, at least, I should say, the first three names she gave to her children, her constant efforts in tefillot to gain Yaakov's love. But not only did she learn from Leah herself, she learned from that which Hashem gave her. Hashem gave her the relationship between her and Yaakov, that relationship that leads to majesty and dignity, that relationship that we said embodies the Midah of Gvura. And only once she was able to learn the Midah of Gvura, right, both from Leah and from the experiences that Hashem enabled her to experience, she was able to incorporate that in herself. And I believe that we see this very clearly in her response to Yaakov's anger. Right after her meltdown, right after she says, my life is not worth living without children, and Yaakov gets angry, she does not, again, self-restraint. She does not respond with upping the ante. She does not respond, how dare you yell at me at this time of my deep sensitivities, and I can't take that right now. Rather, if you turn back to source number 6, she says, Vatomer hinei amati Bilha. She says, okay, take my maidservant Bilha. Have relations with her so that I can have children, so that she can have children upon my knees. I will be built through her. Dina Cooper-Smith suggests that this being built up through Bilha might not only be limited to being built up through her children, but might also be reflecting this idea that she could be built up in terms of her strength of character. That through this whole ordeal that she's experiencing with her lack of children, the act of giving Bilha to her husband will help build her strength of character. Right? The ability to have self-restraint and not respond to Yaakov, but instead do what she saw, put in that effort, right, that Leah had demonstrated Gvura necessitates, to put in that effort for help. That's when we see Rachel most clearly demonstrating her own integration of the Midah of Gvura. On the other hand, Leah already embodied Midat HaGvura, and we see that she needed to learn the Midah of Chesed. She learned it from Rachel, right, in her self-sacrifice, in tacitly or really openly agreeing to allow her to marry her husband, Yaakov. That was the ultimate, one of the ultimate acts of self-sacrifice. But also in her own motherhood. She experienced a life of self-sacrifice, a life of chesed every day through the children that Hashem had given her. And I believe that we see this incorporation of Midah HaChesed into Leah's personality most clearly through the Midrash about her pregnancy with Dina. We know, according to the Midrash, that when Leah became pregnant for the seventh time, she was really pregnant with a male fetus. And Rachel at the time was pregnant with a female fetus. And Leah saw this Baruch HaKodesh, knowing that there would only be a total of 12 Shvatim, and saw that Rachel would therefore have only one son left to have, whereas the Shvachot, the maidservants, would have more than Rachel. And so she davened to Hashem to switch them. And so essentially what Leah did was gave up. She sacrificed the seventh Shevet for the sake of her sister, kind of mirroring her Midah Keneged Midah, where Rachel had given up for her. Once Rachel and Leah learned each other's Midot, and with this we're going to wind down the shir, once they learned from each other's Midot, and only once they did, were they ready to synthesize what they learned with their true essences. And only once they did that did Hashem reward them, so to speak, or really give them what they had been yearning for in the first place. We know that ultimately Rachel gave birth to two children of her own. After Dan and Naphtali were born to her Shifra Bilha, she had Yosef and Binyamin. And according to Rav Hirsch, Leah ultimately earned Yaakov's love. We're not going to do it inside, but if you could look in sources number 14 and 15 on your own, Rav Hirsch explains that through every child that Leah had, and with her naming of that child and with her tefillah, Yaakov came to love her more and more, to the point that by the time her fourth child, Yehuda, was born, Leah no longer refers to his lack of love for her, because she had received it already. And so we see that in their lifetimes, each of them, once they showed Hashem that they can incorporate, that they can actualize not only their own potential in terms of their own natural inclinations, but that they can incorporate their sister's potentials and their positive virtues that their sister, that each sister represented, that's when they were given what they had yearned for the whole time, after they had already developed the other sister's virtues through what they had been given by Hashem in the first place. Not only do we see the fulfillment in their lifetimes of what they had wanted their entire lives, or at least their entire married lives, but we also see this fulfillment post-mortem as well. Unlike Rachel, who had to be buried by herself, al haderech, right, on the way to Eretz Yisrael when she died in childbirth with Binyamin, Leah was zocha to be buried in Ma'arat HaMachpelah, lying alongside Yaakov for eternity, symbolizing that deep connection that they would forever share, right, really, forever, literally, lying side by side, symbolizing that relationship that she had so justifiably earned towards the end of her life. Rachel, on the other hand, despite the fact that Leah was had quantitatively more children, it is Rachel who has become the quintessential aim, the mother who is mevaka al banaha, the mother who cries for her children, for Bnei Yisrael, during their hard times. Although Rachel died tragically before she was able to raise her own two children on their life journeys when they needed her most, Hashem gave her the opportunity, at least, to accompany Bnei Yisrael on their national journey when they needed her most. I think that there are many, many lessons we can learn from Rachel and Leah, in general and from what we learned today. But what I would like to focus on at the end is this idea that, you know, we all have our natural tendencies. We all, especially as adults, as teenagers, adults, we've come to know ourselves. We know our natural inclinations. We know our tendencies. We know what we're like. We know what we like. We know what we dislike. We know who we get along with. We know, you know, what inspires us and what doesn't. However, I think the most important lesson that Leah and Rachel teach us is that it's so important to learn from other people's virtues as well. Even when other people around you may seem to have the opposite tendencies, even when they may seem to have inclinations that are so foreign to you, if they're positive, if they're virtues, then you can only gain by integrating those values, those virtues, those tendencies, those inclinations into your own personality as much as possible. The people with whom we live, with whom we have relationships, they're in our lives for a reason. They're there to challenge us. They're there to help us grow, to help us learn about ourselves. They're there to help us enhance our Bein Adam L'Malkut, the Chaviru relationships, and to enable us to be enhanced by them as well. Thank you so much for having me, and have a great day.